We're continuing in our study of Acts. Text today is chapter 23, verses 12 to 35. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near." Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. And Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, and as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen, and go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also, provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor." And he wrote this letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency, the governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon him with the soldiers and rescued him. Having learned that he was a Roman citizen and desiring to know the charge for which they accused him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their own law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, and on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from, and when he learned he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. Now, political intrigue, conspiracy, there's nothing new to that. Assassination is a regular part of human history. Within monarchies, it would happen within the family itself. Son against father, father against son, brother against brother. The anger and frustration against Paul, however, among these Jews, especially in the province of Asia, was intense. But it's now intense also in Jerusalem. It's so intense that a plot against Paul's life has been developed. Now, this is serious. The Jews made a plot, bound themselves an oath, neither to eat or drink till they had killed Paul. That's pretty serious. So they needed a plan and a way to get at Paul. Trying to attack him in the fortress was almost suicidal. So they came up with this idea to go to the Jewish authorities. We have strictly bound ourselves by oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you along with the council give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we're ready to kill him before he comes. So the plan was an ambush. And as Paul is brought to the Sanhedrin, supposedly to further examine him, they were going to get him. Now the Sanhedrin met in the temple in a building called the Hall of Hewn Stones. They convened every day except festivals and the Sabbath, of course. the fortress was close to the temple. So the planning for the assassination had to be pretty intricate and done with great care. If they had, let's say, 40 or 50 miles or even 4 to 5 miles, it'd be a whole lot easier because there are many more opportunities to attack than this building right next to the temple. The Antonia Fortress stood at the northwestern corner of the Temple Mount, and it was even connected to the temple by porticos, placing it immediately adjacent to the temple complex. That made this killing much more difficult. 40 or so men took the vow not to eat or drink until they did it. Now, about the vow, Longenecker said this. The rabbis allowed 4 types of vows to be broken. A vow of incitement, vows of exaggeration, vows made in error, and vows that cannot be filled by reason of constraint. Exclusions allowing for almost any contingency. The conspirators' plan, though, violating both the letter and the spirit of Jewish law pertaining to the Sanhedrin, was in keeping with the character of the high priest Ananias. So they could weasel out of this thing. They take this vow that they can get out of. They could say, well, we couldn't carry it out because of these soldiers or this or that. They go to the religious leaders with this plot of murder. And they agree to carry out their side of the plan. They're going to have this meeting. They're going to call for Paul to come. And they would stand Paul before them, and he would be questioned yet again. Now, this is evil and corrupt. If they saw Paul as an evil blasphemer trying to overthrow their long-held doctrines, then they should continue their work in the Sanhedrin and convict him of something, or even perhaps take it to the Roman court. But this vigilantism and clandestine murder plot is really evil. But Paul's nephew shows up. Now, the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said to him, "This young man, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." Now, there's minimal information here. As we find so often in scriptural narratives, there's just more that we want to know. We assume that he and Paul's sister were living there in Jerusalem. Did the nephew work for one of the guys involved in the scheme? We don't know. How did he hear about the plot? We want to know, but there's no information given. However he found out, he goes to Paul, reports what he knows, and Paul obviously believed him and had one of the centurions take him to the tribune. Verse 18, so he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say." Verse 19, the tribune took him by the hand and going aside asked him privately, "What is it you have to tell me?" Now, the tribune took the situation seriously because he could have had an attitude. "What do you want, kid? What are you doing here?" You know, that sort of thing. "Don't bother me." But he didn't. Rather, he treats him gently and with respect. That goes to a more private place for him to speak what he had to say. Verse 20, he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though he were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat or drink till they have killed him. And now they're ready for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." He reports what he heard. He doesn't embellish. He doesn't try to impress. He simply bears witness to the things that he had occurred. That really presents a lesson to us, doesn't it? To be a faithful witness is to tell what you know without exaggeration or cover-up. This is true in all of our dealings with others. We're to speak the truth in love. but especially true in bearing witness to Christ. In my teens, I was very actively involved in Youth for Christ. In those days, they had a weekly rally with kids from the whole county that would come in, but then there was also a weekly club meeting at your own respective school. In the club meetings, we often had a time for what we called giving our testimony. That's a merely a quaint way of talking about what's going on with you and the Lord. I believe that most of them were significantly embellished. Kids simply repeated things that they had heard others say, usually adults, and they would talk about the peace and the contentment that they have in the Lord and all of that sort of thing. They didn't talk about their struggle with anger or lust or something like that. Usually they didn't talk about sin at all. It was both an embellishment, better than what their experience was, and cover up by not talking about the struggles of the Christian life. We're called to bear faithful witness. If life is hard, we ought to say so. If we're rejoicing, we ought to say so about that also. We should talk about the good and the hard. Paul's nephew laid out what he knew, straightforward. And that's what we should do. Jerome tells the nephew not to tell anyone about this. The high priest Ananias was corrupt through and through. He couldn't be trusted. Longenecker said that the seriousness with which the commander took the warning about the plot shows that he knew Ananias was the kind of man to fall in with it and realize that the Jewish feeling against Paul was strong enough to nurture such a plot. But think of the wonderful providence in this event. The Jews are scheming. They share their plot with the high priest and his associates, and they just so happen to agree. Somewhere in that process, Paul's nephew just happens to hear about the plot. He's responsible enough to report the plot to Paul. Paul just so happens to take him seriously, and also the tribune. Folks, this didn't just happen. None of it. God was at work circumventing this plot and sparing Paul's life. It is this sovereign God that we trust in and serve. A little plug for the men's study, Sovereignty of God by A.W. Pink, Tuesday night, 7 o'clock. Be here. He's trustworthy even though we don't understand his plan. Even then, he is to be trusted. When what is unfolding in our lives makes sense to us, or actually meets with our approval, then trusting God is easy. But when it goes the other way, when we don't understand, things go against everything we desire, trusting then is hard. But it's still required of us. And God is faithful either way. Either way. Well, Tribune gets to work. Calls two centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen, and go as far as Caesarea on the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor. I mean, this is a massive escort. 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen. Quite an intimidating force. 470 well-armed, well-trained Roman soldiers transport one man from Jerusalem to Caesarea. That was about 65, 70 miles maybe. The Tribune was quite serious about protecting Paul. I wonder if some of that seriousness arose from his former treatment of Paul when he didn't know he was a citizen, was about to beat him, and then learns that he's a citizen, and go, ooh. It's happened to most of us. We make a mistake or a blunder of some sort, or even perhaps intentionally sin. But in response to it, we seek to be way more careful about whatever that issue was or with that particular person. Although we've experienced at the hands of some the opposite, that in the face of a blunder, someone doubles down, denies any problem, makes accusations against the one who was injured by the blunder. That does happen. Let's us seek to do the former. Let's work at avoiding and conquering sin, and let's be quick to confess. Well, Paul must have been quite grateful for this massive escort. That would be cool, wouldn't it, to have a record of the conversations that he had with all these soldiers? I can't imagine that he remained silent over the course of about 2 days as they traveled. It'd be very much like Paul to be communicating the gospel to as many of the escort as possible. Well, the Tribune wrote a letter explaining the situation and why Paul was being transferred. It says, "To His Excellency, the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them, and the soldiers rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving of death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." Now, did you notice that he slants the letter in his own direction a little bit? He mentions nothing about the fact, "Oh yeah, I bound this citizen and I was preparing to beat him." That doesn't come up at all. "I rescued him," comes up. But the facts that Felix needed to know about the case are pretty accurate. Importantly, he points out that Paul is a citizen. His desire is to transfer the entire matter over to the Roman governor. Now, it's hard to be critical of that move. This had trouble written all over it. He could face turmoil in the Sanhedrin if he didn't treat Paul harshly enough. Even the Christians could be displeased with him, although they probably would not have led an uprising against him, but still trouble. As it is today, those in positions of political power must walk carefully. There are always those of various persuasions sitting there waiting to see what you do and how ready you are to pounce with his resistance or at least his criticism. There have been those in my own ministry that you always felt like you were on the test with them. Will you come through for me this time? That's a heavy burden to bear. But in Paul's day, they had always to be concerned with the powers of Rome. What would Rome think? If you messed up badly enough, you could lose your position, or your freedom, or your head. So I'm sure the Tribune was glad to unload this case. So he's sent in protective custody, and the whole case is transferred to the higher court of the governor, Felix. Of Felix, Bible Hub says this: "Governor Felix, known formerly as Antonius Felix, served as a Roman procurator as of Judea from approximately AD 52 to 58. He was appointed by the Emperor Claudius and was known for his harsh and often corrupt administration. Felix was a freedman of Claudius's mother, Antonia, which was a significant factor in his rise to power. His tenure as governor is marked by political unrest and social turmoil, which he often addressed with severe measures." So he's not a very nice guy, but Paul's being sent to him. So he's not being sent into the safest situation, safer than being in Jerusalem, but still difficult. He's held, however, in the hand of Almighty God. Felix or any other Roman dignitary can't have power over God's servant Paul without God's providence guarding and guiding him. Paul, who met the living Christ face to face on the Damascus Road, is right where he needs to be. and his Lord Jesus will stand with him in every court that he enters. Fanny Crosby captured this idea in her song, Safe in the Arms of Jesus. Safe in the arms of Jesus, safe on his gentle breast. There by his love o'ershaded, sweetly my soul shall rest. Hark, 'tis the voice of angels, born in a song to me, o'er the fields of glory, over the Jasper Sea. Safe in the arms of Jesus, safe from corroding care, safe from the world's temptation, sin cannot harm me there. Free from the blight of sorrow, free from my doubts and fears, only a few more trials, only a few more tears. Jesus, my heart's dear refuge, Jesus has died for me. Firm on the rock of ages, ever my trust shall be. Here let me wait with patience, wait till the night is o'er. Wait till I see the morning break on the golden shore. Safe in the arms of Jesus, safe on his gentle breast, there by his love o'ershaded, sweetly my soul shall rest. So he's delivered to Caesarea. Verse 31. The soldiers, according to their instruction, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. He commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. Caesarea Maritima was built by Herod the Great. It was a marvel of ancient engineering, featuring a deep sea harbor, aqueducts, grand public buildings. Herod's judgment hall, likely part of the larger palace complex, served as the official residence of the Roman governor. So that's where he's taken. Now the escort was successful. Paul is delivered safely to Felix. The accusers will now have to come the whole way up to Caesarea. So whether in Jerusalem or Damascus or Lystra or Derbe or Philippi or in the court of Felix, Paul rests in the grace and mercy of God. Oh, may we do the same. Jesus has already died and risen again for us. We can certainly trust him with the day-to-day details of our lives. But more so, we trust him with our souls for all eternity. Rest in Christ's work for you. It's your complete hope. Safe in the arms of Jesus. Safe on his gentle breast. There by his love o'ershaded. Sweetly, my soul shall rest. Let's come to his table.